What if I told you weight loss is not about willpower, cutting carbs, or working harder in the gym, but instead comes down to flipping a specific switch in your body, one that helps flush out unnecessary calories? Heart surgeon and nutrition expert Dr. Stephen Gundry is revealing a new, simple, but insanely effective way to help get a slim, energized, and healthy body with no deprivation, restrictions, or fads. MCT Wellness can help you flip that switch yourself from the comfort of your own home. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. All you do is add a scoop to water and enjoy. Help unlock your body's potential by going to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Chapter 7 of She and Alan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. She and Alan by H. Rider Haggard. Chapter 7. The Oath. We spent 3 more days at that place. First, it was necessary to allow time to elapse before the gases which generated in their great bodies caused those of the sea cows which had been killed in the water to float. Then they must be skinned and their thick hides cut into stripes and pieces to be traded for shamboks or to make small native shields, for which some of the East Coast tribes will pay heavily. All this took a long while, during which I amused or disgusted myself in watching those river natives devouring the flesh of the beasts. The lean, what there was of it, they dried and smoked into a kind of biltong, but a great deal of the fat they ate at once. I had the curiosity to weigh a lump which was given to one thin, hungry-looking fellow. It scaled quite 20 pounds. Within 4 hours he had eaten it to the last ounce, and lay there a distended and torpid log. What would not we white people give for such a digestion? At last all was over, and we started homewards, the man with a broken leg being carried in a kind of litter. On the edge of the bush veld we found the wagon quite safe, also one of Captain Robertson's that had followed us from Strathmore, in order to carry the expected load of hippopotamus hides and ivory. I asked my voorlooper if anything had happened during our absence. He answered nothing, but on the previous evening, after dark, he had seen a glow in the direction of Strathmore, which lay on somewhat lower ground about 20 miles away, as though numerous fires had been lighted there. It struck him so much, he added, that he climbed a tree to observe it better. He did not think, however, that any building had been burnt there, as the glow was not strong enough for that. I suggested that it was caused by some grass fire or reed burning, to which he replied indifferently that he did not think so, as the line of the glow was not sufficiently continuous. There the matter ended, though I confess that the story made me anxious, for what exact reason I could not say. Umslopogaas also, who had listened to it, for our talk was in Zulu, looked grave, but made no remark. But as since his tree-climbing experience he had been singularly silent, of this I thought little. We had trekked at a time which we calculated would bring us to Strathmore about an hour before sundown, allowing for a short halt halfway. As my oxen were got in more quickly than those of the other wagon after this outspan, I was the first away, followed at a little distance by Umslopogaas, who preferred to walk with the Zulus. The truth was that I could not get that story about the glow of fires out of my mind, and was anxious to push on, which had caused me to hurry up the inspanning. Perhaps we had covered a couple of miles of the 10 or 12 which still lay between us and Strathmuir, when far off on the crest of one of the waves of the veld, which must resemble those of the swelling sea frozen while in motion, I saw a small figure approaching us at a rapid trot. Somehow that figure suggested Hans to my mind, so much so that I fetched my glasses to examine it more closely. A short scrutiny through them convinced me that Hans it was, Hans and no other, advancing at great pace. Filled with uneasiness, I ordered the driver to flog up the oxen, with the result that in a little over 5 minutes we met. Halting the wagon, I leapt from the wagon box, and calling to Umslopogaas, who had kept up with us at a slow swinging trot, went to Hans, who, when he saw me, stood still at a little distance, swinging his apology for a hat in his hand, and, as was his fashion, when ashamed or perplexed. "What is the matter, Hans?" I asked, when we were within speaking distance.
"Oh, Baas, everything," he answered, and I noticed that he kept his eyes fixed upon the ground, and that his lips twitched.
"Speak, you fool, and in Zulu," I said, for by now Umslopogaas had joined me.
"Baas," he answered in that tongue, "a terrible thing has come about at the farm of Redbeard yonder. Yesterday afternoon, at the time when people are in the habit of sleeping there till the sun grows less hot, a body of great men with fierce faces who carried big spears, perhaps there were 50 of them, Baas, crept up to the place through the long grass and growing crops and attacked it."
"Did you see them come?" I asked.
"No, Baas, I was watching at a little distance as you bade me do, and the sun being hot, I shut my eyes to keep out the glare of it, so that I did not see them until they had passed me and heard the noise."
"You mean that you were asleep or drunk, Hans? But go on."
"Baas, I do not know," he answered shamefacedly. "But after that I climbed a tall tree with a kind of bush at the top of it."
I ascertained afterwards that this was a sort of leafy crowned palm.
"And from it I saw everything without being seen."
"What did you see, Hans?" I asked him.
"I saw the big men run up and make a kind of circle round the village. Then they shouted, and the people in the village came out to see what was the matter. Tomaso and some of the men caught sight of them first and ran away fast into the hillside at the back where the trees grow, before the circle was complete. Then the women and the children came out, and the big men killed them with their spears. All.
"Good God!" I exclaimed. "And what happened at the house and to the lady?"
"Baas, some of the men had surrounded that also, and when she heard the noise, the lady Sad Eyes came out onto the stoop, and with her came the two Zulus of the axe, who had been left sick but were now quite recovered. A number of the big men ran as though to take her, but the two Zulus made a great fight in front of the little steps of the stoop, having their backs protected by the stoop, and killed 6 of them before they themselves were killed. Also Sad Eyes shot one with a pistol she carried and wounded another so that the spear fell out of his hand. Then the rest fell on her and tied her up, setting her in a chair on the stoop where 2 remained to watch her. They did her no hurt, Baas. Indeed, they seemed to treat her as gently as they could. Also, they went into the house, and there they caught that tall, fat, yellow girl who always smiles and is called Janee, she who waits upon the lady Sad Eyes, and brought her out to her. I think they told her, Baas, that she must look after her mistress, and that if she tried to run away, she would be killed, for afterwards I saw Janee bring her food and other things."
"And then, Hans?"
"Then, Baas, most of the great men rested a while, though some of them went through the store, gathering such things as they liked, blankets, knives, and iron cooking pots, but they set fire to nothing. nor did they try to catch the cattle. Also they took dry wood from the pile and lit big fires, 8 or 9 of them, and when the sun set they began to feast."
"What did they feast on, Hans, if they took no cattle?" I asked with a shiver, for I was afraid of I knew not what.
"Baas,"
answered Hans, turning his head away and looking at the ground,
"they feasted on the children whom they had killed, also on some of the young women. These tall soldiers are man-eaters, Baas."
At this horrible intelligence I turned faint and felt as though I was going to fall, but recovering myself signed to him to go on with his story.
"They feasted quite nicely, Baas," he continued, "making no noise. Then some of them slept while others watched, and that went on all night. As soon as it was dark, but before the moon rose, I slid down the tree and crept round to the back of the house without being seen or heard, as I can, Baas. I got into the house by the back door and crawled to the window of the sitting room. It was opened, and peeping through, I saw Sad Eyes still tied to the seat on the stoop, not more than a pace away, while the girl Janee crouched on the floor at her feet. I think she was asleep or fainting. I made a little noise like a night adder hissing, and kept on making it till at last Sad Eyes turned her head. Then I spoke in a very low whisper, for fear lest I should wake the two guards who were dozing on either side of her, wrapped in their blankets, saying, 'It is I, Hans, come to help you.' 'You cannot,' she answered, also speaking very low. 'Get to your master and tell him and my father to follow. These men are called Amahagger and live far away across the river. They are going to take me to their home, as I understand, to rule them, because they want a white woman to be a queen over them, who have always been ruled by a certain white queen against whom they have rebelled. I do not think they mean to do me any harm, unless perhaps they want to marry me to their chief, but of this I am not sure from their talk, which I understand badly. Now go, before they catch you.' 'I think you might get away,' I whispered back. 'I will cut your bonds. When you are free, slip through the window and I will guide you.' 'Very well, try it,' she said. So I drew my knife and stretched out my arm. If the great medicine had still been there, I might have known better. I forgot the starlight which shone upon the blade of the knife. That girl Janee came out of her sleep or swoon, lifted her head and saw the knife. She screamed once, then at a word from her mistress was silent. But it was enough, for it woke up the guards, who glared about them and threatened Janee with their great spears. Also they went to sleep no more, but began to talk together, though what they said I could not hear, for I was hiding on the floor of the room. After this, knowing that I could do no good and might do harm and get myself killed, I crept out of the house as I had crept in and crawled back to my tree."
"Why did you not come to me?" I asked.
"Because I still hoped I might be able to help Sad Eyes, Baas. Also I wanted to see what happened, and I knew that I could not bring you here in time to be any good. Yes, it is true, I thought of coming, though I did not know the road."
"Perhaps you were right."
"At the first dawn," continued Hans, "the great men who are called Amahagger rose and ate what was left over from the night before. Then they gathered themselves together and went to the house. Here they found a large chair that seated with Rimpis, in which the Baas Red Beard sits, and lashed 2 poles to the chair. Beneath the chair they tied the garments and other things of the lady Sad Eyes, which they made Janee gather, as Sad Eyes directed her. This done, very gently they sat Sad Eyes herself in the chair, bowing while they made her fast. After this 8 of them set the poles upon their shoulders, and they all went away at a trot, heading for the bush veld, driving with them a herd of goats which they had stolen from the farm, and making Janee run by the chair. I saw everything, Baas, for they passed just beneath my tree. Then I came to seek you, following the outward spoor of the wagons, which I could not have done well at night. That is all, Baas."
"Hans," I said, "you have been drinking, and because of it the Lady Sad Eyes is taken a prisoner by cannibals, for had you been awake and watching, you might have seen them coming and saved her and the rest. Still, afterwards you did well, and for the rest you must answer to heaven."
"I must tell your reverend father, the Predicant Baas, that the white master Redbeard gave me the liquor, and it is rude not to do as a great white master does and drink it up. I am sure he will understand, Baas," said Hans abjectly.
I thought to myself that it was true, and that the spear which Robertson cast had fallen upon his own head, as the Zulus say, but I made no answer, lacking time for argument.
"Did you say," asked Umslopogaas, speaking for the first time, "that my servants killed only 6 of these men-eaters?"
Hans nodded and answered,
"Yes, 6. I counted the bodies."
"It was ill done. They should have killed 6 each," said Umslopogaas moodily. "Well, they have left the more for us to finish."
And he fingered the great axe. Just then Captain Robertson arrived in his wagon, calling out anxiously to know what was the matter, for some premonition of evil seemed to have struck him. My heart sank at the sight of him, for how was I to tell such a story to the father of the murdered children and of the abducted girl? In the end I felt that I could not. Yes, I turned coward, and saying that I must fetch something out of the wagon, bolted into it, bidding Hans go forward and repeat his tale. He obeyed unwillingly enough, and looking out between the curtains of the wagon tent, I saw all that happened, though I could not hear the words that passed. Robertson had halted the oxen, and jumping from the wagon box strode forward and met Hans, who began to speak with him, twitching his hat in his hands. Gradually, as the tale progressed, I saw the captain's face freeze into a mask of horror. Then he began to argue and deny, then to weep. Oh, it was a terrible sight to see that great man weeping over those whom he had lost, and in such a fashion. After this a kind of blind rage seized him, and I thought he was going to kill Hans, who was of the same opinion, for he ran away. Next he staggered about shaking his fists, cursing and shouting, till presently he fell of a heap and lay face downwards, beating his head against the ground and groaning. Now I went to him and sat up.
"That's a pretty story, Quatermain, which this little yellow monkey has been gibbering at me. Man, do you understand what he says? He says that all those half-blood children of mine are dead, murdered by savages from over the Zambesi. Yes, and eaten too, with their mothers. Do you take the point? Eaten like lambs. Those fires your man saw last night were the fires on which they were cooked. My little so-and-so and so-and-so,"
and he mentioned half a dozen different names.
"Yes, cooked, Quatermain, and that isn't all of it. They have taken Inez too. They didn't eat her, but they have dragged her off a captain for God knows what reason. I couldn't understand. The whole ship's crew is gone, except the captain absent on leave and the first officer, Tommaso, who deserted with some Lascar stalkers and left the women and children to their fate. My God, I'm going mad. I'm going mad. If you have any mercy in you, give me something to drink."
"All right," I said, "I will. Sit here and wait a minute." Then I went to the wagon and poured out a stiff tot of spirits, into which I put an amazing dose of bromide from a little medicine chest I always carry with me, and 30 drops of chlorodyne on the top of it. All this compound I mixed up with a little water and took it to him in a tin cup, so that he could not see the colour. He drank it at a gulp, and throwing the panicking aside, sat down on the veld, groaning, while the company watched him at a respectful distance, for Hans had joined the others, and his tail had spread like fire in draught-parched grass. In a few minutes the drugs began to take effect upon Robertson's tortured nerves, for he rose and said quietly, "What now?" "Vengeance, or rather justice," I answered. "Yes," he exclaimed, "vengeance. I swear that I will be avenged, or die, or both." Again I saw my opportunity and said, "You must swear more than that, Robertson. Only sober men can accomplish great things, for drink destroys the judgment. If you wish to be avenged for the dead and to rescue the living, you must be sober, or I for one will not help you." "Will you help me if I do, to the end, good or ill, Quatermain?" he added. I nodded. "That's as much as another's oath," he muttered. "Still, I will put my thought in words. I swear by God, by my mother, like these natives, and by my daughter, born in honest marriage, that I will never touch another drop of strong drink until I have avenged those poor women and their little children, and rescued Inez from their murders. If I do, you may put a bullet through me." "That's all right," I said in an offhand fashion, though inwardly I glowed with pride at the success of my great idea, for at the time I thought it great, and went on. "Now, let us get to business. The first thing to do is to trek to Strathmuir and make preparations, the next to start upon the trail. Come to sit on the wagon with me and tell me what guns and ammunition you have got, for according to Hans, those savages don't seem to have touched anything except a few blankets and a herd of goats." He did as I asked, telling me all he could remember. Then he said, "It is a strange thing, but now I recall that about 2 years ago a great savage with a high nose, who talked a sort of Arabic, which, like Inez I understand, having lived on the coast, turned up one day and said he wanted to trade. I asked him what in, and he answered that he would like to buy some children. I told him that I was not a slave dealer. Then he looked at Inez, who was moving about, and said that he would like to buy her to be a wife for his chief, and offered some fabulous sum in ivory and in gold, which he said should be paid before she was taken away. I snatched his big spear from his hand, broke it over his head, and gave him the best hiding with its shaft that he had ever heard of. Then I kicked him off the place. He limped away, but when he was out of reach, turned and called out that one day he would come again with others and take her, meaning Inez, without leaving the price in ivory and gold. I ran for my gun, but when I got back he'd gone, and I never thought of the matter again from that day to this." "Well, he kept his promise," I said, but Robertson made no answer, for by this time that thundering dose of bromide and laudanum had taken effect upon him, and he had fallen asleep, of which I was glad, for I thought that this sleep would save his sanity, as I believe it did for a while. We reached Strathmuir towards sunset, too late to think of attempting the pursuit that day. Indeed, during our trek I had thought the matter out carefully and come to the conclusion that to try to do so would be useless. We must rest and make preparations. Also, there was no hope of our overtaking these brutes, who already had a clear 12 hours start by a sudden spurt. They must be run down patiently by following their spoor, if indeed they could be run down at all, before they vanished into the vast recesses of unknown Africa. The most we could do this night was to get ready. Captain Robertson was still sleeping when we passed the village, and on this I was heartily glad, since the remains of a cannibal feast are not pleasant to behold, especially when they are. Indeed, of these I determined to be rid at once, so slipping off the wagon with Hans and some of the farm boys, for none of the Zulus would defile themselves by touching such human remnants, I made up 2 of the smouldering fires, the light of which the Forloper had seen upon the sky, and onto them cast, or caused to be cast those poor fragments. Also, I told the farm natives to dig a big grave and in it to place the other bodies and generally to remove the traces of murder. Then I went on to the house, and not too soon, seeing the wagons arrive and having made sure that the Amahagger were gone, Tomaso and the other cowards emerged from their hiding places and returned. Unfortunately for the former, the first person he met was Umslopogaas, who began to revile the fat half-bred in no measured terms, calling him dog, coward, and other opprobrious names, such as deserter of women and children, and so forth, all of which someone translated. Tomaso, an insolent person, tried to swagger the matter out, saying that he had gone to get assistance. Infuriated at this lie, Umslopogaas leapt upon him with a roar, and though he was a strong man, dealt with him as a lion does with a buck. Lifting him from his feet, he hurled him to the ground. Then, as he strove to rise and run, caught him again, and, as it seemed to me, was about to break his back across his knee. Just at this juncture I arrived. "Let the man go," I shouted to him. "Is there not enough death here already?"
"Yes," answered Umslopogaas, "I think there is. Best that this jackal should live to eat his own shame."
And he cast Tomaso to the ground, where he lay groaning. Robertson, who was still asleep in the wagon, woke up at the noise and descended from it, looking dazed. I got him to the house, and in doing so made my way past, or rather between, the bodies of the two Zulus and of the six men whom they had killed, also of him whom Inez had shot. Those Zulus had made a splendid fight, for they were covered with wounds, all of them in front, as I found upon examination. Having made Robertson lie down upon his bed, I took a good look at the slain Amahagger. They were magnificent men, all of them, tall, spare and shapely, with very clear-cut features and rather frizzled hair. From these characteristics, as well as the lightness of their colour, I concluded that they were of a Semitic or Arab type, and that the admixture of their blood with that of the Bantus was but slight, if indeed there were any at all. Their spears, of which one had been cut through by a blow of a Zulu's axe, were long and broad, not unlike those used by the Maasai, but of finer workmanship. By this time the sun was setting, and thoroughly tired by all that I had gone through, I went into the house to get something to eat, having told Hans to find food and prepare a meal. As I sat down, Robertson joined me, and I made him also eat. His first impulse was to go to the cupboard and fetch the spirit bottle. Indeed, he rose to do so. "Hans is making coffee," I said warningly.
"Thank you," he answered. "I forgot. Force of habit, you know."
Here I may state that never from that moment did I see him touch another drop of liquor, not even when I drank my modest tot in front of him. His triumph over temptation was splendid and complete, especially as the absence of his accustomed potations made him ill for some time, and of course depressed his spirits, with painful results that were apparent in due course. In fact, the man became totally changed. He grew gloomy but resourceful, also full of patience. Only one idea obsessed him: to rescue his daughter and avenge the murder of his people. Indeed, except his sins, he thought of and found interest in nothing else. Moreover, his iron constitution cast off all the effects of his past debauchery, and he grew so strong that although I was pretty tough in those days, he could out-tire me. To return, I engaged him in conversation, and with his help made a list of what we should require on our vendetta journey, all of which served to occupy his mind. Then I sent him to bed, saying that I would call him before dawn, having first put a little more bromide into his third cup of coffee. After this I turned in, and notwithstanding the sight of those remains of the cannibal feast and the knowledge of the dead men who lie outside my window, I slept like a top. Indeed, it was the captain who awakened me, not I the captain, saying that daylight was on the break and we had better be stirring. So we went down to the store, where I was thankful to find that everything had been tidied up in accordance with my directions. On our way, Robertson asked me what had become of the remains, whereon I pointed to the smouldering ashes of one of the great fires. He went to it, and kneeling down, said a prayer in broad Scotch, doubtless one that he had learnt at his mother's knee. Then he took some of the ashes from the edge of the pyre, for such it was, and threw them into the glowing embers, where, as he knew, lay all that was left of those who had sprung from him. Also he tossed others of them into the air, though what he meant by this I did not understand, and never asked. Probably it was some rite indicative of expiation, or of revenge, or both, which he had learnt from the savages among whom he had lived so long. After this we went into the store, and with the help of some of the natives, or half-breds, who had accompanied us on the sea-cow expedition, selected all the goods we wanted, which we sent to the house. As we returned thither, I saw Umslopogaas and his men engaged with the usual Zulu ceremonies in burying their two companions in a hole they had made in the hillside. I noted, however, that they did not inter their war axes or their throwing spears with them as usual, probably because they thought that these might be needed. In place of them, they put with the dead little models roughly shaped of bits of wood, which models they killed by first breaking them across. I lingered to watch the funeral and heard Goroko, the witch doctor, make a little speech. "O father and chief of the axe," he said, addressing Umslopogaas, who stood silent leaning on his weapon and watching all, a portentous figure in the morning mist. "O father, O son of the heavens," this was an allusion to the royal blood of Umslopogaas, of which the secret was well known, although it would never have been spoken aloud in Zululand. "O slaughterer Bulalio, O woodpecker who picks the hearts of men, O king slayer, O conqueror of the Halakasi, O victor in a hundred fights, O gatherer of the lily bloom that faded in the hand, O wolfman, captain of the wolves that ravened, O slayer of the Faku, O great one whom it pleases to seem small, because he must follow his blood to the end appointed." This was the opening of the speech, the bongaing, or giving of titles of praise to the person addressed, of which I have quoted but a sample, for there were many more of them that I have forgotten. Then the speaker went on. "It was told to me, though of it I remember nothing, that when my spirit was in me a while ago, I prophesied that this place would flow with blood, and lo, the blood has flowed, and with it that of these our brothers." And he gave the names of the two dead Zulus, also those of their forefathers for several generations. "It seems, father, that they died well, as you would have wished them to die, and as doubtless they desired to die themselves, leaving a tale behind them, though it is true that they might have died better, killing more of the men-eaters, as it is certain they would have done, had they not been sick inside. They are finished, they have gone beyond to await us in the underworld among the ghosts. Their story is told, and soon to their children they will be but names whispered in honour after the sun has set. Enough of them who have showed us how to die as our fathers did before them." Goroko paused a while, then added with a waving of his hands, "My spirit comes to me again, and I know that these our brothers shall not pass unavenged. Chief of the axe, great glory awaits the axe, for it shall feed full. I have spoken."
"Good words," grunted Umslopogaas.
Then he saluted the dead by raising Inkosikaas and came to me to consult about our journey. End of chapter 7 of She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Read by Lars Rolander. Chapter 8 of She and Allan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Chapter 8. Pursuit. After all, we did not get away much before noon, because first there was a great deal to be done. To begin with, the loads had to be arranged. These consisted largely of ammunition, everything else being cut down to an irreducible minimum. To carry them, we took two donkeys there were on the place, also half a dozen pack oxen, all of which animals were supposed to be salted, that is, to have suffered and recovered from every kind of sickness, including the bite of the deadly tsetse fly. I suspected, it is true, that they would not be proof against further attacks. Still, I hoped that they would last for some time, as indeed proved to be the case. In the event of the beasts failing us, we took also 10 of the best of those Strathmuir men who had accompanied us on the sea cow trip, to serve as bearers when it became necessary. It cannot be said that these snuff and butter fellows, for most, if not all of them, had some dash of white blood in their veins, were exactly willing volunteers. Indeed, if a choice had been left to them, they would, I think, have declined this adventure. But there was no choice. Their master, Robertson, ordered them to come, and after a glance at the Zulus, they concluded that the command was one which would be enforced, and that if they stopped behind, it would not be as living men. Also, some of them had lost wives and children in the slaughter, which, if they were not very brave, filled them with a desire for revenge. Lastly, they could all shoot after a fashion, and had good rifles. Moreover, if I may say so, I think that they put confidence in my leadership. So they made the best of a bad business and got themselves ready. Then arrangements must be made about the carrying on of the farm and store during our absence. These, together with my wagon and oxen, were put in the charge of Tomaso, since there was no one else who could be trusted at all. A very battered and crestfallen Tomaso, by the way. When he heard of it, he was much relieved, since I think he feared lest he also should be expected to take part in the hunt of the Amahagger man-eaters. Also, it may have occurred to him that in all probability none of us would ever come back at all, in which case, by a process of natural devolution, he might find himself the owner of the business and much valuable property. However, he swore by sundry saints, for Tomaso was nominally a Catholic, that he would look after everything as though it were his own, as no doubt he hoped it might become.
"Hearken, fat pig," said Umslopogaas,
Hans obligingly translating so that there might be no mistake.
"If I come back, and come back I shall, who travel with the great medicine, and find even one of the cattle of the White Lord, Macumazahn, watcher by night, missing, or one article stolen from his wagon, or the fields of your master not cultivated, or his goods wasted, I swear by the axe that I will hew you into pieces with the axe. Yes, if to do it I have to hunt you from where the sun rises to where it sets, and down the length of the night between. Do you understand, fat pig? Deserter of women and children, who to save yourself could run faster than a buck."
Tomaso replied that he understood very clearly indeed, and that heaven helping him, all should be kept safe and sound. Still, I was sure that in his manly heart he was promising great gifts to the saints if they would so arrange matters that Umslopogaas and his axe were never seen at Strathmuir again, and reflecting that after all the Amahagger had their uses.
However, as I did not trust him in the least, much against their will, I left my driver and voorlooper to guard my belongings. At last we did get off, pursued by the fervent blessings of Thomaso and the prayers of the others that we would avenge their murdered relatives. We were a curious and motley procession. First went Hans, because at following a spoor he was, I believe, almost unequalled in Africa, and with him Umslopogaas and three of his Zulus to guard against surprise. These were followed by Captain Robertson, who seemed to prefer to walk alone and whom I thought it best to leave undisturbed. Then I came, and after me straggled the Strathmuir boys with the pack animals, the cavalcade being closed by the remaining Zulus under the command of Goroko. These walked last, in case any of the mixed bloods should attempt to desert, as we thought it quite probable that they would. Less than an hour's tramp brought us to the bushveld, where I feared that our troubles might begin, since if the Amahagger were cunning, they would take advantage of it to confuse or hide their spoor. As it chanced, however, they had done nothing of the sort, and a child could have followed their march. Just before nightfall we came to their first halting place, where they had made a fire and eaten one of the herd of farm goats, which they had driven away with them, although they left the cattle, I suppose because goats are docile and travel well. Hans showed us everything that had happened, where the chair in which Inez was carried was set down, where she and Jenny had been allowed to walk that she might stretch her stiff limbs, the dregs of some coffee that evidently Jenny had made in a saucepan, and so forth. He even told us the exact number of the Amahagger, which he said totaled 41, including the man whom Inez had wounded. His spoor he distinguished from that of the others, both by an occasional drop of blood and because he walked lightly on his right foot, doubtless for the reason that he wished to avoid jarring his wound, which was on that side. At this spot we were obliged to stay till daybreak, since it was impossible to follow the spoor by night, a circumstance that gave the cannibals a great advantage over us. The next 2 days were repetitions of the first, but on the fourth we passed out of the bushveld into the swamp country that bordered the great river. Here our task was still easy, since the Amahagger had followed one of the paths made by the river dwellers, who had their habitations on mounds, though whether these were natural or artificial I am not sure, and sometimes on floating islands. On our second day in the reeds we came upon a sad sight. To our left stood one of these mound villages, if a village it could be called, since it consisted only of 4 or 5 huts, inhabited perhaps by 20 people. We went up to it to obtain information, and stumbled across the body of an old man lying in the pathway. A few yards further on we found the ashes of a big fire, and by it such remains as we had seen at Strathmuir. Here there had been another cannibal feast. The miserable huts were empty, but as at Strathmuir had not been burnt. We were going away when the acute ears of Hans caught the sound of groans. We searched about, and in a clump of reeds near the foot of the mound we found an old woman with a great spear wound just above her skinny thigh, piercing deep into the vitals, but of a nature which is not immediately mortal. One of Robertson's people, who understood the language of these swamp dwellers well, spoke to her. She told him that she wanted water. It was brought, and she drank copiously. Then, in an answer to his question, she began to talk. She said that the Amahagger had attacked the village and killed all who could not escape. They had eaten a young woman and 3 children. She had been wounded by a spear and fled away into the place where we found her, where none of them took the trouble to follow her, as she was not worth eating. By my direction the man asked her whether she knew anything of these Amahagger. She replied that her grandfathers had, though she had heard nothing of them since she was a child, which must have been 70 years before. They were a fierce people who lived far up north across the great river, the remnants of a race that had once ruled the world. Her grandfathers used to say that they were not always cannibals, but had become so long before because of
a lack of food, and now had acquired the taste. It was for this purpose that they still raided to get other people to eat, since their ruler would not allow them to eat one another. The flesh of cattle they did not care for, although they had plenty of them, but sometimes they ate goats and pigs, because they said they tasted like man. According to her grandfathers, they were a very evil people and full of magic. All of this the old woman told us quite briskly after she had drunk the water, I think because her wound had mortified and she felt no pain. Her information, however, as is common with the aged, dealt entirely with the far past. Of the history of the Amahagger since the days of her forebears she knew nothing, nor had she seen anything of Inez. All she could tell us was that some of them had attacked her village at dawn, and that when she ran out of the hut she was spared. While Robertson and I were wondering what we should do with the poor old creature, whom it seemed cruel to leave here to perish, she cleared up the question by suddenly expiring before our eyes. Uttering the name of someone with whom doubtless she had been familiar in her youth, three or four times over, she just sank down and seemed to go to sleep, and on examination we found that she was dead. So we left her and went on. Next day we came to the edge of the great river. Here a sheet of placid running water about a mile across, for at this time of the year it was low. Perceiving quite a big village on our left, we went to it and made inquiries to find that it had not been attacked by the cannibals, probably because it was too powerful, but that three nights before some of their canoes had been stolen, in which no doubt these had crossed the river. As the people of this village had traded with Robertson and Strathmuir, we had no difficulty in obtaining other canoes from them in which to cross the Zambesi in return for one of our oxen that I could see was already sickening from tsetse bite. These canoes were large enough to take the donkeys that were patient creatures and stood still, but the cattle we could not get into them for fear of an upset. So we killed the two driven beasts that were left to us and took them with us as dead meat for food, while the three remaining pack oxen we tried to swim across, dragging them after the canoes with hide reims round their horns. As a result, two were drowned, but one, a bold-hearted and enterprising animal, gained the other bank. Here again we struck a sea of reeds in which, after casting about, Hans once more found the spoor of the Amahagger. That it was theirs beyond doubt was proved by the circumstance that on a thorny kind of weed we found a fragment of cotton dress which, because of the pattern stamped on it, we all recognized as one of that Inez had been wearing. At first I thought that this had been torn off by the thorns, but on examination we became certain that it had been placed there purposely, probably by Janee, to give us a clue. This conclusion was confirmed when at subsequent periods of the hunt we found other fragments of the same garment. Now it would be useless for me to set out the details of this prolonged and arduous chase, which in all endured for something over 3 weeks. Again and again we lost the trail and were only able to recover it by long and elaborate search, which occupied much time. Then, after we escaped from the reeds and swamps, we found ourselves upon stony uplands where the spoor was almost impossible to follow. Indeed, we only rediscovered it by stumbling across the dead body of that cannibal whom Inez had wounded. Evidently he had perished from his hurt, which I could see had mortified. From the state of his remains, we gathered that the raiders must be about 2 days' march ahead of us. Striking their spoor again on softer ground, where the impress of their feet remained, at any rate to the cunning sight of Hans, we followed them down across great valleys, wherein trees grew sparsely, which valleys were separated from each other by ridges of high and barren land. On these belts of rocky soil our difficulties were great, but here twice we were put on the right track by more fragments torn from the dress of Inez. At length we lost the spoor altogether. Not a sign of it was to be found. We had no idea which way to go. All about us appeared these valleys covered with scattered bush running this way and that, so that we could not tell which of them to follow or to cross. The thing seemed hopeless, for how could we expect to find a little body of men in that immensity? Hans shook his head, and even the fierce and steadfast Robertson was discouraged.
"I fear my poor lassie is gone," he said, and relapsed into brooding, as had become his wont.
"Never say die, it's dogged as does it," I replied cheerfully, in the words of Nelson, who also had learnt what it meant to hunt an enemy over trackless waters, although his were of water. I walked to the top of the rise where we were encamped, and sat down alone to think matters over. Our condition was somewhat parlous. All our beasts were now dead, even the second donkey, which was the last of them, having perished that morning and been eaten, for food was scanty since of late we had met with little game. The Strathmuir men who now must carry the loads were almost worn out, and doubtless would have deserted, except for the fact that there was no place to which they could go. Even the Zulus were discouraged, and said they had come away from home across the great river to fight, not to run about in wildernesses and starve, though Umslopogaas made no complaint, being buoyed up by the promise of his soothsayer Goroko that battle was ahead of him in which he would win great glory. Hans, however, remained cheerful, for the reason, as he remarked vacuously, that the great medicine was with us, and that therefore, however bad things seemed to be, all in fact was well, an argument that carried no conviction to my soul. It was on a certain evening towards sunset that I went away thus alone. I looked about me east and west and north. Everywhere appeared the same bush-clad valleys and barren rises, miles upon miles of them. I bethought me of the map that old Zikali had drawn in the ashes, and remembered that it showed these valleys and rises, and that beyond them there should be a great swamp, and beyond the swamp a mountain. So it seemed that we were on the right road to the home of the White Queen, if such a person existed, or at any rate we were passing over country similar to that which he had pictured or imagined. But at this time I was not troubling my head about White Queens. I was thinking of poor Inez, that she was alive a few days before we knew from the fragments of her dress. But where was she now? The spoor was utterly lost on that stony ground, or if any traces of it remained, a heavy deluge of rain had washed them away. Even Hans had confessed himself beaten. I stared about me helplessly, and as I did so a flying ray of light from the setting sun, reflected downwards from a storm cloud, fell upon a white patch on the crest of one of the distant land waves. It struck me that probably limestone outcropped at this spot, as indeed proved to be the case. Also that such a patch of white would be a convenient guide for any who were travelling across that sea of bush. Further, some instinct within seemed to impel me to steer for it, although I had all but made up my mind to go in a totally different direction, many more points to the east. It was almost as though a voice were calling to me to take this path and no other. Doubtless this was an effect produced by weariness and mental overstrain. Still, there it was, very real and tangible, one that I did not attempt to combat. So next morning at the dawn I headed north by west, laying my course for that white patch and for the first time breaking the straight line of our advance. Captain Robertson, whose temper had not been bettered by prolonged and frightful anxiety, or I may add, by his unaccustomed abstinence, asked me rather roughly why I was altering the course. "Look here, Captain," I answered, "if we were at sea and you did something of the sort, I should not put such a question to you, and if by any chance I did, I should not expect you to answer. Well, by your own wish, I am in command here, and I think that the same argument holds."
"Yes," he replied. "I suppose you have studied your chart. If there is any of this godforsaken country, and at any rate discipline is discipline, so steam ahead and don't mind me."
The others accepted my decision without comment. Most of them were so miserable that they did not care which way we went. Also, they were good enough to repose confidence in my judgment.
"Doubtless the Baas has reasons," said Hans dubiously. "Although the spoor when last we saw it headed towards the rising sun, and as the country is all the same, I do not see why those man-eaters should have returned."
"Yes," I said, "I have reasons, although in fact I had none at all." Hans surveyed me with a watery eye as though waiting for me to explain them, but I looked haughty and declined to oblige.
"The Baas has reasons," continued Hans, "for taking us on what I think to be the wrong side of that great ridge, there to hunt for the spoor of the men-eaters, and they are so deep down in his mind that he cannot dig them up for poor old Hans to look at. Well, the Baas wears the Great Medicine, and perhaps it is there that the reasons sit. Those Strathmuir fellows say that they can go no further and wish to die. Umslopogaas has just gone to them with his axe to tell them that he is ready to help them to their wish. Look, he is got there, for they are coming quickly, who after all prefer to live."
Well, we started for my white patch of stones, which no one else had noticed, and of which I said nothing to anyone, and reached it by the following evening, to find, as I expected, that it was a lime outcrop. But now we were in a poor way, for we had practically nothing left to eat, which did not tend to raise the spirits of the party. Also, that lime outcrop proved to be an uninteresting spot overlooking a wide valley which seemed to suggest that there were other valleys of a similar sort beyond it, and nothing more. Captain Robertson sat stern-faced and despondent at a distance, muttering into his beard, as had become a habit with him. Umslopogaas leaned upon his axe and contemplated the heavens, also occasionally by the Strathmuir men who cowered beneath his eye. The Zulus squatted about sharing such snuff as remained to them in economic pinches. Goroko, the witch doctor, engaged himself in consulting his spirit by means of bone throwing upon the humble subject of whether or no we should succeed in killing any game for food tomorrow, a point on which I gathered that his spirit was quite uncertain. In short, the gloom was deep and universal, and the sky looked as though it were going to rain. Hans became sarcastic, sneaking up to me in his most aggravating way, like a dog that means to steal something and cover up the theft with simulated affection. He pointed out one by one all the disadvantages of our present position. He indicated, per contra, that if his advice had been followed, his conviction was that even if we had not found the man-eaters and rescued the lady called Sad Eyes, our state would have been quite different. He was sure, he added, that the valley which he had suggested we should follow was one full of game, inasmuch as he had seen their spoor at its entrance.
"Then why did you not say so?" I asked.
Hans sucked at his empty corncob pipe, which was his way of indicating that he would like me to give him some tobacco, much as a dog groans heavily under the table when he wants a bit to eat, and answered that it was not for him to point out things to one who knew everything, like the great Macumazahn, Watcher by Night, his honoured master. Still, the luck did seem to have gone a bit wrong. The privations could have been put up with. Here he sucked very loudly at the empty pipe and looked at mine, which was alight. Everything could have been put up with, if only there had been a chance of coming even with those man-eaters and rescuing the lady Sad Eyes, whose face haunted his sleep. As it was, however, he was convinced that by following the course I had mapped out, we had lost their spoor finally, and that probably they were now 3 days' march away in another direction. Still, the Baas had said that he had his reasons, and that, of course, was enough for him. Hans, only if the Baas would condescend to tell him, he would, as a matter of curiosity, like to know what the reasons were. At that moment I confess that, much as I was attached to him, I should have liked to murder Hans, who I felt, believing that he had me on toast, to use a vulgar phrase, was taking advantage of my position to make a mock of me in his sly Hottentot way. I tried to continue to look grand, but felt that the attitude did not impress. Then I stared about me as though taking counsel with the heavens, devoutly hoping that the heavens would respond to my mute appeal. As a matter of fact, they did. "There is my reason, Hans," I said in my most icy voice, and I pointed to a faint line of smoke rising against the twilight sky on the further side of the intervening valley. "You will perceive, Hans," I added, "that those Amahagger cannibals have forgotten their caution and lit a fire yonder, which they have not done for a long time. Perhaps you would like to know why this has happened. If so, I will tell you. It is because for some days past I have purposely lost their spoor, which they knew we were following, and lit fires to puzzle them. Now, thinking that they have done with us, they have become incautious and shown us where they are. That is my reason, Hans." He heard, and although of course he did not believe that I had lost the spoor on purpose, stared at me till I thought his little eyes were going to drop out of his head. But even in his admiration he contrived to convey an insult as only a native can.
"How wonderful is the great medicine of the Opener of Roads, that it should have been able thus to instruct the Baas," he said. "Without doubt the great medicine is right, and yonder those men-eaters are encamped, who might just as well as have been anywhere else within 100 miles.
"Drat the great medicine," I replied, but beneath my breath, then added aloud, "Be so good, Hans, as to go to Umslopogaas and to tell him that Macumazahn, or the great medicine, proposes to march at once to attack the camp of the Amahagger, and here is some tobacco."
"Yes, Baas,"
answered Hans humbly, as he snatched the tobacco and wriggled away like a worm. Then I went to talk with Robertson. The end of it was that within an hour we were creeping across that valley towards the spot where I had seen the line of smoke rising against the twilight sky. Somewhere about midnight we reached the neighbourhood of this place. How near or how far we were from it we could not tell, since the moon was invisible, as of course the smoke was in the dark. Now the question was, what should we do? Obviously there would be enormous advantages in a night attack, or at least in locating the enemy, so that it might be carried out at dawn before he marched. Especially was this so, since we were scarcely in a condition, even if we could come face to face with them, to fight these savages when they were prepared and in the light of day. Only we two white men, with Hans, Umslopogaas and his Zulus, could be relied upon in such a case, since the Strathmuir mixed bloods had become entirely demoralized and were not to be trusted at a pinch. Indeed, tired and half-starving as they were, none of us was at his best. Therefore, a surprise seemed our only chance, but first we must find those whom we wished to surprise. Ultimately, after a hurried consultation, it was agreed that Hans and I should go forward and see if we could locate the Amahagger. Robertson wished to come too, but I pointed out that he must remain to look after his people, who, if he left them, might take the opportunity to melt away in the darkness, especially as they knew that heavy fighting was at hand. Also, if anything happened to me, it was desirable that one white man should remain to lead the party. Umslopogaas too volunteered, but knowing his character, I declined his help. To tell the truth, I was almost certain that if we came upon the men-eaters, he would charge the whole lot of them and accomplish a fine but futile end after hacking down a number of cannibal barbarians, whose extinction or escape remained absolutely immaterial to our purpose, namely the rescue of Inez. So it came about that Hans and I started alone, I not at all enjoying the job. I suppose that there lurks in my nature some of that primeval terror of the dark, which must continually have haunted our remote forefathers of a hundred or a thousand generations gone, and still lingers in the blood of most of us. At any rate, even if I am named the Watcher by night, greatly do I prefer to fight or to face peril in the sunlight, though it is true that I would rather avoid both at any time. In fact, I wished heartily that the Amahagger were at the other side of Africa, or in heaven, and that I, completely ignorant of the person called Inez Robertson, were seated smoking the pipe of peace on my own stoop in Durban. I think that Hans guessed my state of mind, since he suggested that he should go alone, adding with his usual unveiled rudeness that he was quite certain that he would do much better without me, since white men always made a noise. "Yes," I replied, determined to give him a Roland for his Oliver. "I have no doubt you would, under the first bush you came across, where you would sleep till dawn, and then return and say that you could not find the Amahagger." Hans chuckled, quite appreciating the joke, and having thus mutually affronted each other, we started on our quest. End of chapter 8 of She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Read by Lars Rolander.
Chapter 9 of She and Allan. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Chapter 9. The Swamp. Neither Hans nor I carried rifles that we knew would be in the way on our business, which was just to scout. Moreover, one is always tempted to shoot if a gun is at hand, and if this I did not want to do at present. So, although I had my revolver in case of urgent necessity, my only other weapon was a Zulu axe that formerly had belonged to one of those two men who died defending Inez on the veranda at Strathmuir, while Hans had nothing but his long knife. Thus armed or unarmed, we crept forward towards the spot whence, as we conjectured, we had seen the line of smoke rising some hours before. For about a quarter of a mile we went on thus without seeing or hearing anything, and a difficult job it was in that gloom among the scattered trees with no light, save such as the stars gave us. Indeed, I was about to suggest that we had better abandon the enterprise until daybreak, when Hans nudged me, whispering,
"Look to the right, between those twin thorns."
I obeyed, and following the line of sight which he had indicated, perceived at a distance of about 200 yards a faint glow, so faint indeed that I think only Hans would have noticed it. Really, it might have been nothing more than the phosphorescence rising from a heap of fungus, or even from a decaying animal.
"The fire of which we saw the smoke that has burnt to ashes,"
whispered Hans again.
"I think that they have gone, but let us look."
So we crawled forward very cautiously, to avoid making the slightest noise, so cautiously indeed that it must have taken us nearly half an hour to cover those 200 yards. At length we were within about 40 yards of that dying fire, and afraid to go further, came to stand, or rather a lie still, behind some bushes until we knew more. Hans lifted his head and sniffed with his broad nostrils. Then he whispered into my ear, but so low that I could scarcely hear him,
"Amahagger there all right, Baas. I smell them."
This, of course, was possible, since that what wind there was blew from the direction of the fire, although I, whose nose is fairly keen, could smell nothing at all. So I determined to wait and watch a while, and indicated my decision to Hans, who, considering our purpose accomplished, showed signs of wishing to retreat. Some minutes we lay thus, till of a sudden this happened.
A branch of resinous wood, of which the stem had been eaten through by the flames, fell upon the ashes of the fire and burnt up with a brilliant light. In it we saw that the Amahagger were sleeping in a circle round the fire, wrapped in their blankets. Also we saw another thing, namely that nearer to us, not more than a dozen yards away, indeed, was a kind of little tent, also made of fur rugs or blankets, which doubtless sheltered Inez. Indeed, this was evident from the fact that at the mouth of it, wrapped up in something, lay none other than her maid Janee, for her face being towards us, was recognized by us both in the flare of the flaming branch. One more thing we noted, namely that two of the cannibals, evidently a guard, were sleeping between us and the little tent. Of course they ought to have been awake, but fatigue had overcome them, and there they slumbered, seated on the ground, their heads hanging forward, almost upon their knees. An idea came to me. If we could kill those men without waking the others in that gloom, it might be possible to rescue Inez at once. Rapidly I weighed the pros and cons of such an attempt. Its advantages, if successful, were that the object of our pursuit would be carried through without further trouble, and that it was most doubtful whether we should ever get such a chance again. If we returned to fetch the others and attacked in force, the probability was that those Amahagger, or one of them, would hear some sound made by the advance of a number of men, and fly into the darkness, or, rather than lose Inez, they might kill her. Or if they stood and fought, she might be slain in the scrimmage. Or, as after all we had only about a dozen effectives, for the Strathmuir bearers could not be relied upon, they might defeat and kill us, whom they outnumbered by 2 or 3 to 1. These were the arguments for the attempt. Those for not making it were equally obvious. To begin with, it was one of extraordinary risk. The two guards or someone else behind them might wake up. For such people, like dogs, mostly sleep with one eye open, especially when they knew that they are being pursued. Or if they did not, we might bungle the business so that they raised an outcry before they grew silent for ever, in which case both of us, and perhaps Inez also, would probably pay the penalty before we could get away. Such was the horn dilemma upon one point or other of which we ran the risk of being impaled. For a full minute or more I considered the matter with an earnestness almost amounting to mental agony, and at last all but came to the conclusion that the danger was too enormous. It would be better, notwithstanding the many disadvantages of that plan, to go back and fetch the others. But then it was that I made one of my many mistakes in life. Most of us do more foolish things than wise ones, and sometimes I think that in spite of a certain reputation for caution and far-sightedness, I am exceptionally cursed in this respect. Indeed, when I look back upon my past, I can scarcely see the scanty flowers of wisdom that decorate its path because of the fat, ugly trees of error by which it is overshadowed. On that occasion, forgetting past experiences where Hans was concerned, my natural tendency to blunder took the form of relying upon another's judgment instead of my own. Although I had formed a certain view as to what should be done, the pros and cons seemed so evenly balanced that I determined to consult the little Hottentot and accept his verdict. This, after all, was but a form of gambling like pitch and toss, since, although it is true, Hans was a clever, or at any rate a cunning man, according to his lights, and experienced, it meant that I was placing my own judgment in abeyance which no one considering a life and death enterprise should do, taking the chance of that of another, whatever it might be. However, not for the first time I did so, to my grief. In the tiniest of whispers, with my lips right against his smelly head, I submitted the problem to Hans, asking him what we should do, go on or go back. He considered a while, then answered in a voice which he contrived to make like the drone of a night beetle.
"Those men are fast asleep.
I know it by their breathing. Also the Baas has the Great Medicine. Therefore I say, go on, kill them and rescue Sad Eyes."
Now I saw that the fate to which I had appealed had decided against me and that I must accept their decree. With a sick and sinking heart, for I did not at all like the business, I wondered for a moment what had led Hans to make this view, which was directly opposite to any I had expected from him. Of course his superstition about the Great Medicine had something to do with it, but I felt convinced that this was not all. Even then I guessed that two arguments appealed to him, of which the first was that he desired, if possible, to put an end to this intolerable and unceasing hunt which had worn us all out, no matter what the end might be. The second and more powerful, however, was, I believed, and rightly, that the idea of this stealthy midnight blow appealed irresistibly to the craft of his half-wild nature, in which the strains of the leopard and the snake seemed to mingle with that of the human being. For be it remembered that notwithstanding his veneer of civilization, Hans was a savage whose forefathers for countless ages had preserved themselves alive by means of such attacks and stratagems. The die having been cast, in the same infinitesimal whispers we made our arrangements, which were few and simple. They amounted to this, that we were to creep on to the men and each of us kill that one who was opposite to him, I with the axe and Hans with his knife, remembering that it must be done with a single stroke, that is, if they did not wake up and kill us, after which we were to get Inez out of her shelter, dressed or undressed, and make off with her into the darkness, where we were pretty sure of being able to baffle pursuit until we reached our camp. Provided that we could kill the two guards in the proper fashion, rather a large proviso, I admit, the thing was simple as shelling peas, which, notwithstanding the proverb, in my experience is not simple at all, since generally the shells crack the wrong way and at least one of the peas remained in the pod. So it happened in this case, for Janni, whom we had both forgotten, remained in the pod. I am sure I don't know why we overlooked her. Indeed, the error was inexcusable, especially as Hans had already experienced her foolishness and she was lying there before our eyes. I suppose that our minds were so concentrated upon the guard killing and the tragic and impressive Inez that there was no room in them for the stolid and matter-of-fact Janni. At any rate, she proved to be the pea that would not come out of the pod. Often in my life I have felt terrified, not being by nature one of those who rejoices in dangers and wild adventures for their own sake, which only the stupid do, but who has, on the contrary, been forced to undertake them by the pressure of circumstances, a kind of hydraulic force that no one can resist, and who, having undertaken, has been carried through them, triumphing over the shrinkings of his flesh by some secret reserve of nerve power. Almost I am tempted to call it spirit power, something that lives beyond and yet inspires our frail and fallible bodies. Well, rarely have I been more frightened than I was at this moment. Actually, I hung back until I saw that Hans, slithering through the grass like a thick yellow snake with a great knife in his right hand, was quite a foot ahead of me. Then my pride came to the rescue, and I spurted, if one can spurt upon one's stomach, and drew level with him. After this we went at a pace so slow that any able-bodied snail would have left us standing still. Inch by inch we crept forward, lying motionless a while after each convulsive movement, once for quite a long time, since the left-hand cannibal seemed about to wake up, for he opened his mouth and yawned. If so, he changed his mind and, rolling from a sitting posture onto his side, went to sleep much more soundly than before. A minute or so later the right-hand ruffian, my man, also stirred so sharply that I thought he had heard something. Apparently, however, he was only haunted by dreams resulting from an evil life, or perhaps by the prescience of its end, for after waving his arms and muttering something in a frightened voice, he too, wearied out, poor devil, sank back into sleep. At last we were on them, but paused because we could not see exactly where to strike, and knew, each of us, that our first blow must be the last and fatal. A cloud had come up and dimmed what light there was, and we must wait for it to pass. It was a long wait, or so it seemed. At length that cloud did pass, and in faint outline I saw the classical head of my Amahagger bowed in deep sleep, with a heart beating as it does only in the fierce extremities of love or war. I hissed like a snake, which was our agreed signal. Then, rising to my knees, I lifted the Zulu axe and struck with all my strength. The blow was straight and true. Umslopogaas himself could not have dealt a better. The victim in front of me uttered no sound and made no movement, only sank gently on to his side, and there lay as dead as though he had never been born. It appeared that Hans had done equally well, since the other man kicked out his long legs, which struck me on the knees. Then he also became strangely still. In short, both of them were stone dead, and would tell no stories this side of Judgment Day. Recovering my axe, which had been wrenched from my hand, I crept forward and opened the curtain like rugs or blankets. I do not know which they were that covered Inez. I heard her stir at once. The movement had wakened her, since captives sleep lightly. "Make no noise, Inez," I whispered. "It is I, Allan Quatermain, come to rescue you. Slip out and follow me. Do you understand?" "Yes, quite," she whispered back and began to rise. At this moment a blood-curdling yell seemed to fill earth and heaven, a yell at the memory of which even now I feel faint, although I am writing years after its echoes died away. I may as well say at once that it came from Janee, who, awaking suddenly, had perceived against the background of the sky Hans standing over her, looking like a yellow devil with a long knife in his hand, which she thought was about to be used to murder her. So, lacking self-restraint, she screamed in the most lusty fashion, for her lungs were excellent, and the game was up. Instantly, every man sleeping round the fire leapt to his feet and rushed in the direction of the echoes of Janee's yell. It was impossible to get Inez free of her tent arrangement or to do anything except whisper to her, "Feign sleep and know nothing. We will follow you. Your father is with us." Then I bolted back into the bushes, which Hans had reached already. A minute or two later, when we were clear of the hubbub and nearing our own camp, Hans remarked to me sententiously,
"The great medicine worked well, Baas, but not quite well enough for what medicine can avail against a woman's folly."
"It was our own folly we should blame," I answered. "We ought to have known that fool girl would shriek and taken precautions."
"Yes, Baas, we ought to have killed her too, for nothing else would have kept her quiet,"
replied Hans in cheerful assent.
"Now we shall have to pay for our mistake, for the hunt must go on."
At this moment we stumbled across Robertson and Umslopogaas, who with the others and every living thing within a mile or two had also heard Janee's yell, and briefly told our story. When he learned how near we had been to rescuing his daughter, Robertson groaned, but Umslopogaas only said,
"Well, there are two less of the man-eaters left to deal with. Still, for once your wisdom failed you, Macumazahn. When you had found the camp, you should have returned.
so that we might all attack it together. Had we done so before dawn, there would not have been one of them left."
"Yes," I answered, "I think that my wisdom did fail me, if I have any to fail. But come, perhaps we may catch them yet." So we advanced, Hans and I showing the road, but when we reached the place it was too late, for all that remained of the Amahagger or of Inez and Janny were the two dead men whom we had killed, and in that darkness pursuit was impossible. So we went back to our camp to rest and await the dawn before taking up the trail, only to find ourselves confronted with a new trouble. All the Strathmuir half-breeds whom we had left behind as useless had taken advantage of our absence and that of the Zulus to desert. They had just bolted back upon our tracks and vanished into the sea of bush. What became of them I do not know, as we never saw them again, but my belief is that these cowardly fellows all perished, for certainly not one of them reached Strathmuir. Fortunately for us, however, they departed in such a hurry that they left all their loads behind them, and even some of the guns they carried. Evidently Janice gel was the last straw which broke the back of such nerve as remained to them. Doubtless they believed it to be the signal of attack by hordes of cannibals. As there was nothing to said or done, since any pursuit of these curs was out of the question, we made the best of things as they were. It proved a simple business. From the loads we selected such articles as were essential, ammunition for the most part to carry ourselves, and the rest we abandoned, hiding it under a pile of stones in case we should ever come that way again. The guns they had thrown aside we distributed among the Zulus who had none, though the thought that they possessed them, so far as I was concerned, added another terror to life. The prospect of going into battle with those wild axemen letting off bullets in every direction was not pleasant, but fortunately when that crisis came, they cast them away and reverted to the weapons to which they were accustomed. Now all this sounds much like a tale of disaster, or at any rate of failure. It is, however, wonderful by what strange ways good results are brought about. So much so that at times I think that these seeming accidents must be arranged by an intelligence superior to our own, to fulfil through us purposes of which we know nothing, and frequently, be it admitted, of a nature sufficiently obscure. Of course, this is a fatalistic doctrine, but then, as I have said before, within certain limits I am a fatalist. To take the present case, for instance, the whole Inez episode at first sight might appear to be an excrescence on my narrative, of which the object is to describe how I met a certain very wonderful woman and what I heard and experienced in her company. Yet it is not really so, since had it not been for the Inez adventure, it is quite clear that I should never have reached the home of this woman, if woman she were, or have seen her at all. Before long this became very obvious to me, as shall be told. From the night upon which Hans and I failed to rescue Inez, we had no more difficulty in following the trail of the cannibals, who thenceforward were never more than a few hours ahead of us and had no time to be careful or to attempt to hide their spoor. Yet so fast did they travel that, do what we would, burdened and wearied as we were, it proved impossible to overtake them. For the first 3 days the track ran on through a scattered rolling bush veld of the character that I have described, but tending continually downhill. When we broke camp on the morning of the fourth day, eating a hasty meal at dawn, for now game had become astonishingly plentiful, so that we did not lack food, the rising sun showed beneath us an endless sea of billowy mist stretching in every direction, far as the sight could carry. To the north, however, it did come to an end, for there, as I judged 50 or 60 miles away, rose the grim outline of what looked like a huge fortress, which I knew must be one of those extraordinary mountain formations, probably owing their origin to volcanic action,
that are to be met with here and there in the vast expanses of Central and Eastern Africa. Being so distant, it was impossible to estimate its size, which I guessed must be enormous, but in looking at it, I bethought me of that great mountain in which Zikali said the marvellous White Queen lived, and wondered whether it could be the same, as from my memory of his map upon the ashes it well might be, that is, if such a place existed at all. If so, the map had shown it as surrounded by swamps, and, well, surely that mist hid the face of a mighty swamp. It did indeed, since before nightfall, following the spoor of those Amahagger, we had plunged into a morass so vast that in all my experience I have never seen or heard of its like. It was a veritable ocean of papyrus and other reeds, some of them a dozen or more feet high, so that it was impossible to see a yard in any direction. Here it was that the Amahagger ahead of us proved our salvation, since without them to guide us we must soon have perished, for through that gigantic swamp there ran a road, as I think an ancient road, since in one or two places I saw stonework which must have been laid by man. Yet it was not a road which it would have been possible to follow without a guide, seeing that it also was overgrown with reeds. Indeed, the only difference between it and the surrounding swamp was that on the road the soil was comparatively firm, that is to say, one seldom sank into it above the knee, whereas on either side of it quagmires were often apparently bottomless and, what is more, partook of the nature of quicksand. This we found out soon after we entered the swamp, since Robertson, pushing forward with a fierce eagerness which seemed to consume him, neglected to keep his eye upon the spoor and stepped off the edge onto the land that appeared to be exactly similar to its surface. Instantly he began to sink in greasy and tenacious mud. Umslopogaas and I were only 20 yards behind, yet by the time we reached him in answer to his shouts already he was engulfed up to his middle, and going down so rapidly that in another minute he would have vanished altogether. Well, we got him out, but not with ease, for that mud clung to him like the tentacles of an octopus. After this we were more careful. Nor did this road run straight. On the contrary, it curved about and sometimes turned at right angles, doubtless to avoid a piece of swamp over which it had proved impossible for the ancients to construct a causeway, or to follow some outcrop of harder soil beneath. The difficulties of that horrible place are beyond description, and indeed can scarcely be imagined. First, there was that of a kind of grass which grew among the roots of the reeds, and had edges like those of knives. As Robertson and I wore gaiters, we did not suffer so much from it, but the poor Zulus with their bare legs were terribly cut about and in some cases lame. Then there were the mosquitoes which lived here by the million, and all seemed anxious for a bite. Also snakes of a peculiarly deadly kind were numerous. A Zulu was bitten by one of them of so poisonous a nature that he died within 3 minutes, for the venom seemed to go straight to his heart. We threw his body into the swamp, where it vanished at once. Lastly, there was the all-pervading stench and the intolerable heat of the place, since no breath of air could penetrate that forest of reeds, while a minor trouble was that of the multitude of leeches which fastened to our bodies. By looking one could see the creatures sitting on the underside of leaves with their heads stretched out, waiting to attack anything that went by. As wayfarers there could not have been numerous, I wondered what they had lived on for the last few thousand years. By the way, I found that paraffin, of which we had a small supply for our hand lamps, rubbed over all exposed surfaces, was to some extent a protection against these blood-sucking worms and the gnats, although it did make one go about smelling like a dirty oil tin. During the day, except for the occasional rush of some great iguana or other reptile, and the sound of the wings of the flocks of wild fowl passing over us from time to time, the march was deathly silent. But at night it was different, for for then the bullfrogs boomed incessantly, as did the bitterns, while great swamp owls and other night flying birds uttered their weird cries. Also there were mysterious sucking noises caused, no doubt, by the sinking of areas of swamp, with those of bursting bubbles of foul uprushing gas. Strange lights, too, played about the will-o'-the-wisps or St. Elmo's fires, as I believe they are called, that frightened the Zulus very much, since they believed them to be spirits of the dead. Perhaps this superstition had something to do with their native legend that mankind was torn out of the reeds. If so, they may have imagined that the ghosts of men went back to the reeds, of which there were enough here to accommodate those of the entire Zulu nation. Anyway, they were much scared. Even the bold witch doctor Goroko was scared and went through incantations with the little bag of medicines he carried to secure protection for himself and his companions. Indeed, I think even the iron Umslopogaas himself was not as comfortable as he might have been, although he did inform me that he had come out to fight and did not care whether it were with man or wizard or spirit. In short, of all the journeys that I have made, with the exception of the passage of the desert on our way to King Solomon's mines, I think that through this enormous swamp was the most miserable. Heartily did I curse myself for ever having undertaken such a quest in a wild attempt to allay that sickness, or rather to quench that thirst of the soul which, I imagine, at times assails most of those who have hearts and think or dream. For this was at the bottom of the business. This it was which had delivered me into the hands of Zikali, Opener of Roads, who, as now I am sure, was merely making use of me for his private occult purposes. He desired to consult the distant oracle, if such a person existed, as to great schemes of his own, and therefore, to attain his end, made use of my secret longings which I had been so foolish as to reveal to him, quite careless of what happened to me in the process.
A bit narrow and uncharitable view this view, it seems to me that Zikali is taking a big risk in giving him the great medicine.
J.B. Well, I was in for the business and must follow it to the finish, whatever that might be. After all, it was very interesting, and if there were anything in what Zikali said, if there were not, I could not conceive what object he had in sending me on such a wild goose chase through this home of geese and ducks. It might become more interesting still, for being pretty well fever-proof, I did not think I should die in that morass, as of course 9 white men out of 10 would have done. And beyond it lay the huge mountain, which day by day grew larger and clearer. Nor did Hans, who with a childlike trust pinned his faith to the great medicine. This, he remarked, was the worst veld through which he had ever travelled, but as the great medicine would never consent to be buried in that stinking mud, he had no doubt that we should come safely through it some time. I replied that this wonderful medicine of his had not saved one of our companions who had now made a grave in the same mud.
"No, Baas," he said, "but those Zulus have nothing to do with the medicine which was given to you and to me who accompanied you when we saw the Opener of Roads. Therefore, perhaps they will all die, except Umslopogaas, whom you were told to take with you. If so, what does it matter, since there are plenty of Zulus, although there be but one Macumazahn or one Hans? Also the Baas may remember that he began by offending a snake, and therefore it is quite natural that this snake's brother should have bitten the Zulu."
"If you're right, he should have bitten me, Hans."
"Yes, Baas, and so no doubt he would have done had you not been protected by the great medicine, and me too, had not my grandfather been a snake charmer, to say nothing of the smell of the medicine being on me as well. The snakes know those that they should bite, Baas."
"So do the mosquitoes," I answered, grabbing a handful of them. "The great medicine has no effect upon them.
Oh yes, Baas, it has, since though it pleases them to bite, the bites do us no harm, or at least not much, and all are made happy. Still, I wish we could get out of this reach of which I never want to see another. And Baas, please keep your rifle ready, for I think I hear a crocodile stirring there.
No need, Hans, I remarked sarcastically. Go and tell him that I have the great medicine.
Yes, Baas, I will. Also that if he is very hungry, there are some Zulus camped a few yards further down the road.
And he went solemnly to the reeds a little way off and began to talk to them. You infernal donkey, I murmured, and drew my blanket over my head in a vain attempt to keep out the mosquitoes, and smoking furiously with the same object, tried to get to sleep. At last the swamp bottom began to slope upwards a little, with the result that as the land dried through natural drainage, the reeds grew thinner by degrees, until finally they ceased, and we found ourselves on firmer ground. Indeed, upon the lowest slopes of the great mountain that I have mentioned, that now towered above us, forbidden and majestic. I had made a little map in my pocketbook of the various twists and turns of the road through the vast slough of despond, marking them from hour to hour as we followed its devious wanderings. On studying this at the end of that part of our journey, I realized afresh how utterly impossible it would have been for us to thread that misty maze where a few false steps would always have meant death by suffocation, had it not been for the spoor of those Amahagger travelling immediately ahead of us who were acquainted with its secrets. Had they been friendly guides, they could not have done us a better turn. What I wondered was why they had not tried to ambush us in the reeds, since our fires must have shown them that we were close upon their heels. That they did try to burn us out was clear from certain evidences that I found, but fortunately at this season of the year, in the absence of a strong wind, the rank reeds were too green to catch fire. For the rest, I was soon to learn the reason of their neglect to attack us in that dense cover. They were waiting for a better opportunity. End of chapter 9 of She and Allan by H. Rider Haggard. Read by Lars Rolander.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.